Ayatollah Khamenei says the main enemy confronting Iran is the global arrogance rather than the ill-informed individuals or hired agents stirring up riots. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified attacks on Kurdish militants there. Also in the headlines, Ukraine's president says the Russian missile strikes have left millions of households without power. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei, has addressed a group of besieged forces in the capital, Tehran. The leader said the main enemy confronting Iran is the global arrogance rather than ill-informed individuals or hired agents stirred up riots. Stirring up the riots, that is, Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemies are trying to spread lies and fake news and paint a dark picture of Iran. That's because, he added, they want to have dominance over the minds of the Iranian people. Also in his remarks, the leader rejected negotiations with the United States to resolve disputes. He said the talks will not solve any problems unless by paying ransom or crossing the red lines. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979. He said the revolution tipped the balance against the favor of arrogant powers in West Asia, dealing a heavy blow to their colonialist policies. The leader added the creation of the usurper Israeli regime was in line with those policies to maintain dominance over the region. Hakima Zakhaya Berea is an academic and political analyst. She joined us earlier with her take on the speech delivered by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the beginning of Besiege Week.
You know, when you look at U.S. history of relations with other countries, you see that the United States looks at the countries around the world in as one of two cases. One is a client country and the other is an enemy country. An enemy is a country that systematically acts independent of the United States, doesn't want to give ransom to the United States, and, you know, looks for its own interests rather than, trying to take care of the interests of the United States in its region. That is the role that the clients play. Now, Iran, with its revolution, became one of the main enemies of the United States. That is not what we did, but that is what the United States eyes, Iran becomes an enemy just by having a revolution that makes it independent. So here, there are two scenarios. One is that a country is weak enough for the United States to be able to overthrow it, as you know the United States has done in some countries where they had revolutions. For example, in Congo, they had a revolution. They had an independence from the Belgians. And then over a period of 1 year, you know, they had a coup and they removed Patrice Lumumba and they killed him and everything was over, okay? And they had a friendly government, so to speak. But sometimes you have a country like Iran, which is more resilient, that doesn't, you know, old tactics sometimes don't work. So you need to have a step-by-step and a more hybrid scenario for dealing with that country. And that is what has happened with Iran, that from the beginning, many different, instruments have been used. One of them is negotiations, so to call. But I would like to say that it is not negotiations, but it is coercive diplomacy.
Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid the intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this goal, which has been repeatedly decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated to the Syrian opposition said Turkey carried out a new raids on the northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it intensified the strikes since last week. when an explosion in Istanbul killed 6 people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria, but they have denied the allegation. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and a serious sovereignty. Independent political analyst Mohammed Hassan Dabl says Turkey's attacks on Syria are a serious threat to peace and stability in the region.
This is really a serious concern for the region in terms of peace and stability. As you know, the ethnic spillover, the effect of this war will have the consequences could not be imagined. It could lead to an all-out war. It could even involve Iran to take actions in support of the Syrians. They are taking advantage at the moment of the current situation where Russia, that had a lot of influence over in Syria, is at the moment involved in the Ukraine war, and Turkey is taking advantage of that, trying to expand its influence in the northern in the northern Syrian areas.
The Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts amid Russia's missile onslaught. Volodymyr Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital Kiev and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and a further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate, but Kiev says attacks on infrastructure are intended to harm civilians. That makes them a war crime. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, gives details on how the critical situation in Ukraine, including massive blackouts, is affecting the lives of people there.
They're reaching chaotic levels now, the situation for Ukrainian people. Power out in large parts of the country, huge problems with water. The situation is critical, according to Ukrainian officials. And as you say, this may well cause another major refugee crisis into Western Europe. Russia trying to bring Ukraine to its knees, trying to bring it to the negotiating table by making it impossible for the Ukrainian government to look to provide even the most basic necessities to their people, and it could cause significant loss of life, particularly if it starts affecting hospitals. Now, will Ukraine be able to sustain these attacks on the energy infrastructure? The president's wife recently went on television saying that Ukrainians are willing and able to live without water and electricity for 2 to 3 years. She cited a survey which said 90% of respondents said so. It's also important to recognize that Ukraine has become an intensely repressive state. It's banned all independent media. It's banned most political parties. It has a very large and active intelligence agency, the SBU. It has far-right extremist military battalions that round up government critics, and particularly pro-Russian critics, and that often kills them. That's been well reported even by mainstream press now. So a combination of that kind of determination, genuine determination by Ukrainian people, and an intensely repressive state means that Ukraine may well be able to sustain these attacks on its infrastructure.
Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nurses in Britain are planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase has been turned down by the government. The strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union would be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales and Northern Ireland will be walking out on December 15th and the 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that would help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to the demands of the healthcare workers.
What the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the health secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged the difficult situation that healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of the unprecedented inflation. He stressed that his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. The planned strikes by the nurses would be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors. They're struggling to get by as the UK grapples with a 40-year high inflation rate of 11.1%.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. These lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well. I do have spare batteries in case. We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualised, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualised.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for a similar reason. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Purizap, London.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to address thousands of his supporters during a rally held between the capital Islamabad and neighboring Rawalpindi. This is Khan's first public appearance since being shot earlier this month in an assassination attempt. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kalutz. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the kaluts, or yardangs. Other researchers believe the yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky. But studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Mega Dunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Mega Dunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kalutz or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kalutz area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kalutz, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kalutz are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many qanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalut formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz, but the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kalutz or Yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutz of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutes in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutes in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutz. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kalutz for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kalutz, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the sun, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kalutz redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeved shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeved shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent, and as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and these goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kalutz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kalutz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kalutz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kalut depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalut's basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kalut's with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as kalate and kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kaluts of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark when, on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in it. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of huge mountains back there towards the kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just the perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to. And when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear, and if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to a new episode of For a Better Life. You are listening to IRB English Radio. This is Asma. I study literature, and it's been quite a while that I come here to share my ideas with you. Not as a lecturer, of course, but as someone who is just as eager as everyone out there to find the road to a better life, which is actually the essence of our existence. Previously on For a Better Life, we actually went through some pieces of advice given by Luqman to his son. We actually went through too much of nice advices that might be so much of useful in our today's life. Well, we learned that we should not go for the consent of other people, because no matter what you do, you will never make every single being in this world to feel satisfied with you. No matter how much you try, this is not going to happen. The satisfaction of every single being around you is something that is so far-fetched, and actually it's not going to happen. Therefore, you have to go for the satisfaction of Allah, and that is the major thing that counts and matters in our life. And also, we went through this fact that we should not talk with other people with a loud voice, because in the Holy Book of Quran, where this advice has been mentioned, we understand that being modest with other people is a virtue, and we should not actually talk in a loud voice to every single person in this world, because it's not something desirable and it is not the thing that satisfies Allah. Another issue was actually the fact that we should get away from the sins, or at least lighten up the sins that we are carrying through our shoulders, because we have a journey in this life and this journey is not going to be an easy one. Therefore, we have to lighten whatever we carry with ourselves in order to get to the desired purpose, that is actually getting close to Allah in heaven and reunite with Him.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, since there were some of the devices left in here, we're going to focus on some more of these advices, and I will read them for you. Oh my son, if you doubt death, take a sleep away from yourself. You are unable to do so. And if you doubt the doomsday, take a weakness away from yourself. Neither can you do this. When you think over these issues, you will understand that you are controlled by somebody else. Sleep is death, and awakeness after sleep is your resurrection. My son, the world is a deep sea in which an immense number of people are drowned. You use your faith in God as your ship in the sea. Let assurance in God be your sails. Let your piety be your provisions. If you cross the sea safely, it is because of God's blessings. And if you are destroyed, this is because of your own sins. O my son, be so frightful of God that although you have done all the good that jinni and men have performed, you still fear God might punish you, and trust God so much that if you have committed the sins of all jinni and men, God will forgive you. O my son, for anything there is a sign by which it is recognized. For religion, there are three signs: knowledge, faith, and acting according to them. For faith, there are three signs: believing in God, His Book, and His Prophets. For a scholar, there are three signs: knowing God, knowing knowledge, knowing what God likes or dislikes. For believers, there are three signs: prayer, fasting, and zakat. That is actually an Islamic ritual that everyone has to spend specified items to be used for Muslims' welfare. For a person who is not qualified for a job but accepted anyway, there are three signs: he quarrels with his superior, he tells things he doesn't know, and he tries to do something he is not qualified for. For a tyrant, there are three signs: he is disobedient towards his superiors, he uses hegemonistic behavior towards his inferiors, and helps other tyrants. For sinners, there are three signs: committing treason, telling lies, behaving opposite to their sayings. For a hypocrite, there are three signs: his tongue opposes his heart is in contrast with his actions, and his appearance is in contrast with his innate portion. For a jealous person, there are three signs. He backbites in one's absence, apple-polishes in one's presence, and blames one when he is in trouble. For a squanderer, there are three signs. He sells things that are not his, dresses something which does not fit him, and eats foods which are not his. For a lazy person, there are three signs. He procrastinates affairs so much that he is left behind. He dissipates so much that he spoils the work. He wastes so much that he commits sin. For a neglectful one, there are three signs: errors, entertainments, and forgetting. Now, in order to get to the other advices, let's go for a short break and we'll get back very soon. Thank you for staying with us. Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to For a Better Life. Actually, it's been some sessions that we're talking about Luqman's advices to his son that are actually so handy in today's life, and we might make use of them in every single step that we take in the journey of our life. Actually, the thing that we're mentioning right in here in these two sessions are very much delicate and so important at the very same time, you know? There are some sort of things that we might notice and claim that, okay, I know it all. But the truth is, when it comes to practice, we do not seem to be actually making use of whatever we know. Now, everybody knows that lying is not a good thing. But it might happen in our life that sometimes we get in the terrible and in the trap of the lying, and then we call it that is a white lie, or that is a thing that I never meant to hurt anyone with. Whatever, I'm just giving you an example. I mean, whatever that we're going through today and in the previous episode are actually simple things, but practicing them is the thing that is actually very much difficult and is the whole story, of course. And another device Luqman says to his son: my son, be aware when you are in front of God, you will be asked three kinds of questions. From your youth, how you have spent it. From your life, have you spent it. From your wealth, how you got it and how you spent it. So make yourself ready for such a day and prepare yourself for the answers. Do not regret what you have lost in this world. It is because of you have little. It will not last, and if you have much, it is vulnerable. Take your provisions and try in your work and draw aside the curtains of negligence and perform the heavily duties and renew repentance in your heart and get ready to depart this life before death comes to you and before here is a space between you and what you wish to do. My son, do not postpone repentance because death will arrive unexpectedly. Do not curse death. Do not make fun of anybody in trouble. Do not refuse to carry on good work. There are very much of evidences that we can observe in our life that people do not intend to hurt anyone. Maybe they do not intend to hurt anyone, but unconsciously, they actually make fun of someone without noticing the fact that that person, that single person, is being so hurt from whatever they have just said. So I hope all the advices that we read be a light that would help us go into a better life. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying tuned, for being with me, and for listening to today's episode until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.